Good evening. I'm Trish England, and welcome to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. Did you know all our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on Racing History Project's website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and also on the Internet Archive, archive.org. That's brand new. We've got a really special event tonight. I'm so tickled to be here with everyone in the audience and with our guests Rob Dyson and Price Cobb, both of them IMSA GTP winners, lots and lots of more, and they have plenty to talk about. Let me go back to this. This is a story of two very different young drivers just starting out with wild visions of race and glory, one from Texas, the other from New York. In a flash of thunder and lightning, they met at the Bob Bondurant Driving School way out in California in 1973, setting off a friendship and working relationship that has endured the decades. One was a Texas maverick pursuing and grabbing rides wherever he could, by the race or by the contract. The other was a Yankee entrepreneur who strove relentlessly to turn his racing passion into a world-class team. They both succeeded. Who do you think had more fun? Tonight we present Price Cobb, the Texan, and Rob Dyson, the New Yorker. Their careers ran parallel and yet intertwined many times. They raced together as teammates. They raced against each other as friendly rivals. They drove all the great cars, ran on all the great circuits, raced with all the great drivers, and won the greatest races and championships. Not many drivers can say that. Let's listen to Price and Rob and their tales of the fun times, the hard times, and the glory they chased since the beginning. How about that? That's pretty good. Who wants to get started?
Huh? That's pretty amazing, and I certainly appreciate it. I think I'm happy to start and it was just an amazing time for me, youngster, fresh out of high school. I know Rob is hardly any older than myself. I know that I was heck-bent on pursuing racing, at least until I figured out that I couldn't do it on a level that it might make sense for a living, and then at which time I would go back to college at the behest of my parents. But as history would show, you know, I was lucky enough to go out to Bondurant and ran into Rob Dyson. And I would have to say that for me it was life-changing. And even though there was times, you know, long times after I left Rob, you always look back on the successes and life that Rob and Dyson Racing taught me, meaning many choices I made going forward came directly from Rob's suggestions to me as a youngster. And, Rob, to this day, I thank you for those.
Well, you know, it's interesting when, Trish, the way you just portrayed it, it is kind of interesting. It was a happenstance. There were five people in the Bob Bondurant School at Ontario Motor Speedway. And incidentally, Price may not remember this, but there were two things that were kind of interesting factoids just about that. One was, as we were pulling out of the track, the wrecking trucks were pulling in to tear it down. We were the last cars on the Ontario Motor Speedway grounds. The other thing is that all the driver's suits and helmets that we used were from the movie Le Mans. And all of those outfits, all the different driver's suits that came from the movie Le Mans, became quite valuable on the aftermarket. And I guess Bondurant didn't even know it either. He just gave them to some guy, and he started selling them off. So that's just an interesting factor. But the thing that's interesting about it is Price and I just hit it off. And I was out in California working as an accountant between first and second year of graduate school. And I was about eight or nine years older than Price. But we just hit it off. And what I appreciated about him was the fact that he was, you know, he really wanted to take it seriously, as did I. Now, I didn't have any idea of taking it any further, but I was a race fan up to my eyeballs, and I said, I want to see what it's like out there. And so I was working out there between first and second year of grad school in Los Angeles. I said to my wife, Emma, I said, look, let's go on out there. I'm going to do the five-day school. And there was Price, and Bill Ebert, Price, was with us. And I just heard from Bill, believe it or not, just 2 days ago. He follows Chris's racing out of his farm in Springfield. So I've told him about this podcast, so I'm going to make sure he tunes in on it. But anyway, I will tell you, Price and I, it was just, we hit it off. We were friends. We were friends when we were working together. We were friends when we weren't. But it was just, Price Cobb was a major part of our success, really. And it was, we had a great time, just a great time.
You guys, I recall one ironic I can't say defining, but just thick irony moment at Bonneron. So they were moving from Porsches over to Datsuns because, you know, they relocated after the wrecking ball incident that Rob talked about. And if you flash forward, certainly my career, if not a great deal of Datsun Racing's essence, was based on Porsches. And I had the honor of breaking the last Porsche they ever had. So, there you go.
What did you do to it?
It broke a drive shaft, or half shaft, if you will, that comes out of the transmission. And of course, being some punk, I didn't know what the heck was happening other than it was making a heck of a racket. And what can I say? You know, pulled over sheepishly, and they ran over and said, you know, accused me of breaking it. And then they all broke out with laughter. Just it was a common problem. On a school car, you know.
Yes, anyway.
Exactly. You know, school cars, a Porsche. Go ahead.
I can guarantee you that Price didn't break it. Price had the best mechanical feel of any driver we ever had. And you know, it wasn't Price. I mean, it was all the other people that had preceded both of us in driving all of these cars at the driver's school. And you're right, he was moving over to Datsuns, and then he went on, ultimately went on to Mustang, but be that as it may, that was part of it. The other thing was, you could tell that they were going to be displaced, because all of their other stuff was in boxes and all of that, so they were planning, they were on their way out, but we were the last plants in Ontario. It was kind of a funny deal.
They moved to Laguna Seca, didn't they?
I think that's right. Yeah, they went up there for several years, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, they came to Arizona.
Ultimately, they ended up at Firebird, I think.
That's right. That's right. So from there, I think, Trish, my recollection is that Rob and I parted ways, you know, having met each other and had a great time. And I went off and pursued open wheel racing, because that was sort of the starry eyed part of my life, having done some go-kart racing prior to that. And I think, and Rob speak up, but I think you pursued some sedan racing, and both of us had an amazing sort of calamitous wonderment of learning how to drive.
Price was absolutely taking, you know, open wheel cars is, you know, formula cars, that's the deal. And that was the pinnacle. And in that era, there was a lot of very viable and important open wheel venues. The same thing was true when I got out of grad school. I said to my wife, I said, look, I've been following racing. I want to see what it's like to go out there and actually do it. So I started researching it. While I was in grad school, my second year of grad school, I said, look, I'm going to research this. And I picked out the Datsun 510 for two reasons. First, there were a lot of them, and they're parts. They had lots of parts. Datsun, now Nissan, had a lot of parts available, race parts that you could get. So I knew that that was good. I didn't want to race a car where I'm chasing parts all over the place. So I started doing then. And what was interesting is Price and I hooked up when they had the Formula Atlantic race at Lime Rock, and I think the Formula Atlantic race was the same weekend as a club racing race that I was in at the same time, and so we got reunited there. I think that's what happened.
You know me, I'd love to chime in, but my brain's not that good. There's no question that we ran into each other again, and I do believe also at Lime Rock, Rob, but I just don't recall.
Well, you know, the other funny thing is we were out running a Firebird. I was out running a Firebird. I graduated from a Datsun 510. We went to a 200SX that was provided to me by the Datsun factory. And then, because I won a Northeast division, and then we built a Firebird, and we're out in Michigan. Well, lo and behold, we're out there in Michigan with this absolute piece of rubbish of a car, this Pontiac Firebird. It really couldn't do anything well. And I'm looking over, and I'm seeing another guy in a Camaro, put together by I can't remember the entrance name. But it said Cobb, Pete Cobb.
Yeah, Gordy
Oftedal. That's right, Gordy Oftedal. And I saw Price. I said, oh, Christ, we're going to be racing against one another at Michigan on the road course, along with the prototypes. And so, unfortunately, our car didn't last one or two laps before the engine went. But that's for another time where Price and I are kind of past intertwined. You know, it was all just kind of coincidental and happenstance, but we kept on running into one another.
Rob, do you recall that weekend you came over to me and news to me, it looked like you'd been considering a prototype at that time because you asked me one-on-one if I thought your team could handle a Porsche 962. And, of course, I was personally taken aback because to me a car is a car is a car, and I know that even Trish rolls her eyes up in her head when I say that, but I said if you knock it down, you rub off the fact that it's a Porsche or the fact that it's pretty fancified, you know, it's got carbon fiber bits instead of stamped sheet metal, but the reality is it's just another car. And I, if I recall right, I assured you that your team was more than capable of running that car. Little that I know, it didn't take you too much longer to make that choice to move that direction.
Yeah, it was a funny deal because the Pontiac was teaching us a whole lot of thing about the discipline of dealing with a car that was truly a prototype. And Bob Aiken, who Price and I knew a lot for all of our racing, and I was thinking about Bob the other day in that car, that new car that you drove, my dad's new car down to Bob's place, that, I don't know, the Chevrolet or something.
with the keys
rattling in the ashtray, and you guys thought there was some problem with it. But anyway, so, but Bob Aiken came to me and said, look, you're wasting your time. You know, you got to move up. And I said, well, I'm also talking to the people at March. And he said, look, Rob, nobody collects marches. So I'm going to introduce you to Al Hobart, which he did. And Al put together a deal with me and Bruce Levin. And that kind of started it. The sad thing about it was is that when we first started running the Porsche, it was me and Drake Olson. And that was a trip up. It was sad that I didn't think about Price, but at the time, I think, I don't know what you were doing in 85. Were you doing anything?
I don't think so. I think I was just, you know, working for a guy hoping to get a job. You know, I mean, a racing job. So I was
yeah. Anyway, so we started racing with Drake, and it was progressively more difficult. It was not a relationship that worked well. And we needed, we got a Budweiser deal. And the Budweiser deal consisted of five or six races. But the big one was Columbus. And they didn't want me to race with Drake. They wanted another pro. And at first they wanted another driver. And I said, no, I'd really prefer not to. Let me get Price Cobb. And they said, he would be successful, sure. And yeah. So I called Price and said, hey, you know, you ready? Come on up and we'll do a race up at Watkins Glen as a preliminary. And we ran three cars, and I don't know, it was a two and a half or three hour race. We ran with three guys. It was a lot looser. All the driver setups and everything was a lot looser in those days. And Price came up and he came by the house and ran at Lime Rock. And, you know, Price took about 10 minutes getting used to it. Then we went up to Watkins Glen and got it going. And then Price and Drake, I said, gee, this is going to work better than I thought. And Drake and Price ran the Columbus race and won it. And because Price did the best thing. Drake started the race, but Price was got in second. But they had we pitted intelligently and ended up in the lead. And there was a full course yellow for something. And Price came out and said, we're gonna smoke these guys quickly because on the restart. And that's exactly what he did. And he brought it home. And I said to Pat Smith, who Price over the years got to be really close to, and I said to Pat, I said, boy, we got the right guy in Price. And that was a confirmation that everything went well, and we built on that.
Yeah, but let me remind everybody, and perhaps yourself too, Rob, about the reality of it. So you brought me up to Lime Rock. Again, we had a friendship, we still do, and you put me into a car that was so far different than anything I'd ever driven in my life. If you recall, the last thing I'd driven at that time was a Formula Super V, which is very Formula Atlantic-like, but weighed 900 pounds and had maybe off of a cliff 200 horsepower. So now you put me into a closed cockpit car that I hadn't driven in a while and had a turbocharger on it, which I'd also never experienced. And now we're at Lime Rock with that wonderful uphill. And, Rob, I tell you what, I found out what true fear was right that day. And thank gosh we got through it. I went to Watkins Glen, and if you recall then, Rob, the back straight, so up through the S's, you know, turn 2, 3, 4, up through the S's in the back straight, the straightaway itself was crowned in such a way that the car would change, you know, sort of directions violently as you went from one side of the road to the other, trying to let people by you. So now I was truly doubting my choices, respected my friendship, but I was trying to figure out how I was going to tell you maybe I shouldn't be doing this. And so then by the graces of God, we got to go to Columbus, and I was always comfortable at street races. So I knew that it would, you know, remove the fearful aspects of driving a car like the 962 at speed, because let's face it, I don't know if we even went 160 miles an hour in Columbus. And suddenly, you know, I still wasn't as fast as Drake, but I started to become one with the car, and that was a turning point for me, Rob, and I appreciate you giving me that opportunity.
Well, you know, it was kind of funny because Watkins Glen had just reopened. It had been literally abandoned for 7 or 8 years when it went broke. And Corning Glass took it over because they didn't know what to do with it, but they felt that it was a community asset. So they bought it. Well, International Speedway bought the track, and they needed events. Well, International Speedway and NASCAR had a piece of IMSA. They helped found IMSA. So they put us out on the track, and I had run that track several times because it was a northeast track when I was club racing in the 70s, and here we are in 85, and the track had not been used probably for 5 or 6 years, and Price was absolutely right. Going down the back straight, it was frightening. Because the frost heaves and the straightaway literally fought your car side to side. I remember that, and I remember how afraid you were. I remember you were really spooked. And the only thing I said to him is, hey, "Look, we're all bouncing. I mean, we were losing the fillings out of our teeth." And I checked with the guy, Bob Aiken being one of them. I said, Bob, this track is terrible. He says, yeah, but, you know, we're running here and everybody's bouncing along. Just hang on and just do what you can. That's what I related to Bryce and even to myself, because I was going to run there. It was going to be me and Drake. But then to get ready for Columbus, I wanted to make sure Price had some seat time in a race environment. And so off we went, and I was in the car very little. Greg probably started. I got in the car a little bit, and then Price took it home. And I think he got out of the car saying, well, okay, we're better than, you know, we can do it. But remember, Price, you had a lot of Formula Atlantic experience, and that wasn't screwing around either.
No, I mean, realize that. It just, for me, again, Rob, it was just the environment was so different, you know, and then the turbochargers back then, if you recall, were the size of a small, you know, jet engine. I mean, it just took forever to wake them up. And so it was just new to me, and it was a rude awakening, to say the least. Before we move away from Watkins Glen, Rob, do you remember, and I'm hoping you remember the year, when Ford had the probe and they asked you to stay behind the following Monday? I'm sure they were trying to get you to run a probe instead of a Porsche. And I think it was Tom Gloy in the car. Do you remember that catastrophic cold Monday after a race? Do you remember that?
You know, I remember they wanted us to they needed another entrant to run a car, and that Ford probe was a very, very difficult car, and it was actually revolutionary in the way they were building it, the way they were running it. But I don't remember, did they want us to test it?
They wanted us to test it. So it was you and I, and that Monday morning it was blustery. And, of course, thank gosh, nobody was around anymore but for the Ford team. I guess it was Zach Speed and you and myself.
Yeah.
And I want to say it was Tom Gloy in the car. Forgive me if I'm wrong, but they sent him out just to warm it up, just to make sure it was right before they were going to stick me or you into it. And, you know, first lap, no problem. Second lap, all of a sudden, it may be the third lap, and then you know how that little four-cylinder, and if it's the only car that's there, you can clearly hear it going up through the S's and onto the back straight, and all of a sudden everything went silent. And unfortunately, the rear deck on that car was a clamshell that opened by the driver's cockpit and then rocked back, you know, so it would open the engine, but it was still attached to the car. So if it didn't stay shut, that was a problem. So that was a scoop that would lift the car off the ground. Well, indeed, the clasps failed. It opened up, lifted the car off the track, threw it over the trees, and it landed in that RV park area where people would have been normally. And thank God, nobody got hurt, either, you know, neither Tom Gloy or anybody else. And then you and I looked at each other and we said, well, time to leave.
That's exactly right. That, you know, the funny thing about that was, I was a little skeptical about it, but to me it was kind of everything that I did in racing kind of just sort of happened. It sort of, you know, it wasn't any grand design. I was just wanted to go out racing. And even the progress of moving up in classes wasn't a result of any grand design. It was just, hey, it's another challenge. Let's see what it's like. So with Price, the benefit that I had with Price was, I knew it was somebody that, A, I could absolutely trust in every respect, not only in the setup, because Price was in charge of the setup in any car that he and I drove. But the other thing is I knew at the end of the day, the car, when it came my turn, the car would be in one piece, because Price had a remarkable mechanical feeling and sense. So the thing was is that when they had, the car was slick. That Ford probe was really slick, but it was absolutely freezing. We had our driver suits on. We were getting ready to go and get into this thing. I didn't know what to even expect. And right, Gloy was lucky he didn't get really, really hurt. But the car was virtually destroyed. And that's when I said, well, Price, this test has ended. And, you know, I never heard from those guys again. Never heard from those guys again. And I got a lot of respect for Tom Gloy, and I always thought that he was a good guy. But that, in fact, the Ford probe was a very, very difficult program, and they never really got it going. They were spectacular cars in qualifying, but the cars, as far as being able to run any length of time, really never could put it together. Never put it together.
Do you, and for me, though, if you recall, Rob, it was sort of, it was somebody else in the world making another attempt at producing a, in this case it was carbon fiber, but let's just say a reinforced plastics car, a la Jim Hall from years before. And so for all of us, we were intrigued. But Rob, I also, maybe you didn't have a grand scheme, but one of the things I recall vividly that you suggested I look at as I go through life choosing race cars or teams to be with was the possibility / reliability inherent in whatever it is you're driving. Because at the end of the day, the proverbial, in order to finish first, you must first finish. So I took your words with me for all of time. In other words, when I had an opportunity, and I'm going to make some of this up, to drive a Ferrari that on paper looked faster than a Porsche, or a BMW that looked on paper faster than Porsche, I always stood back, recalled the times that we'd had or the words you'd given me. I thought, you know what, there's huge value in that. And not only when you chose a Porsche, even if on paper it wasn't the quickest, because the company themselves stood shoulder to shoulder with you at every venue, that's hard to beat. And that's, what can I tell you? The rest is history.
Well, I think that's right. The thing that was interesting about it was that we had a very, with that Firebird that we had, which was built by a good friend, who had short and circle track experience. Not road racing, not to the degree that you'd need for a car to race a GTO car in IMSA at that level. But I went to him saying, look, this guy's, I know him, he's a good guy, and let's, you know, let's just put one together. And that car had to be constantly updated, and it has to be constantly repaired, had to be constantly adjusted. And I said, God, we're racing a prototype. And that's when Bob Aiken said to me, you guys are working too hard, not getting any results. Although, ironically, Ken Slagle, who was a very club racing champion of note, he drove with me in a 500-miler at Elkhart Lake. And I'm still to this day, I can't figure out why I didn't bring Cobb into the program earlier, and it was much to my regret. But the thing, and probably his, but the thing that's interesting is we ran that Firebird and finished third overall in a 500-mile race in 1984. So we must have done something right to get that done. But as far as I remember, I don't think we finished three races in the whole time we ran the car over a 2-year period. So you're right. I mean, and that was when the attraction of the Porsche guys. And so I went over to the Porsche factory to see, go over to the Weissach area. And I said, gee, these guys, they're really behind their product. And it helped. There's no doubt it helped. You got a good car. You got a good car. There's no doubt about it. But you don't have a car that's necessarily going to win, but you got a car that's absolutely going to run. And run forever. You got to tweak it.
Right.
You got to adjust it. You got to work on it.
Yep. Well, and we'll get to it in a second because I want to bring up, Yag and some of the guys that you had that were quite spectacular. But I'll tell everybody listening one of the funny things about Porsche. So all the things I said were true, and all the stuff that Rob just shared with you is true. Great company to stand side by side with if you have to face the onslaught of other manufacturers. But I'll never forget when we had to go to the Porsche truck to pick up some parts. And, Rob, you remember the name of the guy that was the parts guy at that time when we first started? I mean, he was a wonderful guy. He's a character. But where I'm going with the story is that if we took a part, you guys, off the truck, let's say it was a lower control arm. I'm just making this up now, but to paint a picture. We, you know, it was all wrapped up. We take it back to the car and start to fit it, and doggone if it was off by, you know, 16th of an inch. I mean, infinitesimally, but a bolt wouldn't necessarily go in easily unless you wanted to spring it, you know, spread it apart. So we would go back to the truck and say, hey, you know, can we swap this out for another one that's slightly different? And they said, what's the matter? Well, it doesn't fit. Well, it fit when it left here. So I cannot tell you how often they said that. And we weren't the ones damaging it. So it was a push and pull relationship. It was always great fun. But boy, how did they stand behind you? But you guys, there's another thing about Dyson Racing that was always such a pleasure. So the guys, some of the people that he had working for him were just, you know, extremely intelligent and crafty. And I'll never forget, and it was like with pride of being a Dyson member, we were at Columbus, oh, maybe the next year. But it was, and Rob will remember, the guy running True Sports at the time, he walked up to us and he said to me, oh, I see you're running a short wheelbase car. Well, I knew for a fact it was not short wheelbase, but Rob's aerodynamicist had chosen to fool everybody. So we knew we wanted a little bit more front end downforce. So he extended the nose a couple of inches, but as it moved forward, it left a larger gap in front of the front tire. So it looked like a short wheelbase car, but indeed it allowed the air to get out from, you know, underneath the wheel well. And there's also some special louvers on top of the wheel arch that everybody thought were just the typical vent into that. In my life, I was so proud of Dyson Racing because here we were trying to run up against Hulbert in the actual factory car, the car that got all the stuff first, and we could do it quite often.
Yeah, and beat them often. The other thing is that was just part of the Pat Smith, my crew chief. Pat started with me my second year of running club racing because my businesses were starting to get big and I didn't have time to prepare the car. And Pat was a local auto mechanics instructor at a local vocational technical school. But Pat had enormous line flat rate mechanic experience. And a flat rate mechanic is a guy that gets paid a certain amount for doing a job. And if it takes them 2 hours to do it, 20 minutes to do it, or 4 hours to do it, it still gets paid the same. So this was a guy that knew how to really do stuff, make sure it didn't have any comeback, and working at all these different garages and stuff. And he went to teach in Votech to get a bit more steady pay and all that. Well, Pat started with me in the summer, and what would happen is if we went pretty quick, he changed something on a car. This was a Datsun 510 to make it work. And he said, look, let's just try it. We know that you got a pretty good car. Let's see if we can make it better. And by doing just little tweaks, sometimes we did move forward, sometimes we didn't. And that was the same kind of idea we used with the Porsche. We said, look, and we had a guy, Dick Yagami, who was an industrial designer who had a really good sense about mechanics and stuff. But he was an industrial designer and by trade. And he came on board with us, and he came with Drake. But after a while, it didn't make any difference whether Drake was involved or not. He stayed with us. He later went on to Nissan and helped them in their aero program to do the Nissan GTP program. But the thing that was interesting about it is Smitty allowed guys in the shop, whether it was Bozzi or any of the other guys that were in the shop, working on the cars to change stuff. If it made any sense, we tried it. Well, what Price was talking about at Columbus, it enabled us to run a lot quicker on the street because we had more downforce in the front of the car, and the Porsches were notorious for understeer. The cars pushed, and we had a lot more downforce on the car, seemingly, you know, with this stuff, and everybody poo-pooed what we were doing, until we started running it. And then everybody started taking a look and see how they could do it overnight to get that stuff working. But it took a lot more than just what they could see, because there was a whole lot of ducting underneath it too. Kind of a little bit of mini ground effect in the front end of the car, not just the rear.
Well, you can't go
lots of cool stuff for sure. Go ahead.
I'm going to break for a second. We've got to do our station identification. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
All right. Again, this is Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, and also new, the Internet Archive at archive.org. That's interesting. And we don't like the idea of you being poo-pooed on any ideas, okay? How long did Pat stay with you?
Pat worked for me 28 years.
Good grief.
And he was with us for the from my Datsun 510 days until the Lolas and all that the Lolas and I don't think he wasn't with us. He wasn't with us with the Porsches, but he was with us all the way up to the Lolas. And the prototype,
yeah.
Including one kind of stupid foray into IndyCar racing in 1989. Price went off to a Jaguar, and I said, "Well, shit, let's just see if this IndyCar makes any sense." And I can tell you, from top to bottom, it didn't. It may have if we'd have done it differently, but it sure didn't then, because that was when the Chevrolets were coming in, and it just we were really wasting a lot of time, and guys were running all sorts of trick chassis stuff, and we were way behind the eight ball. And
well, you had Roberto Guerrero; he was a decent driver.
Well, yeah, but it just didn't work. Just didn't work. Mm-hmm. So. We went back to sports cars. My idea was I always wanted to have a car that I could drive myself, and I felt pretty comfortable about doing most of the cars that we had. But an Indy car, that was a little bit beyond me.
Did you try it?
But I was going to do Elkhart Lake, but I decided against it because I told my wife when I first started racing I wasn't going to do open wheel cars, and I'm sure as hell wasn't going to do it in that situation because I didn't think the car would be even remotely competitive. And I didn't want to get in any kind of a big argument over something that was just probably ultimately not worth it. So I think it was a good decision. I'll tell you an interesting story about Price and I were running a race up at Elkhart Lake, which is a fabulous racetrack, probably one of the great, great racetracks. We did very well there. But Price got involved with kind of an altercation with the I think it was the Morton's BFG Porsche. It knocked the nose. So it was time for a change anyway. So I was getting into the car. Price was getting out. I was getting into the car. Up in front, pitted up in front, was another guy in a Porsche. I can't remember who it was. But they were having some fuel problems, and Price got out of the car. I got in just as the guy in the Porsche started it up, and they had all this fuel in the turbo, and nothing but a big bright ball of flame flew over the front of the car. And I kept. And when I left, Smitty said, "Get out of here, get going." Because the car had the nose had been put on, and I accelerated that, and I said, "What the hell was that?" And he said, "I don't know, but I think Price is chasing around trying to make sure he's got all his hair from that ball of flame that went by his ears." But it was a big ball of flame, and I think we finished second in that race to Hobart. And there's a great in the video that we've got. my son would come to the races periodically. And there's a great video of me up on Price and I up on a podium. I think it was Holbert that beat us. We came second, and I've got Chris, my son, on my shoulders, and he's patting Price's head.
At least I had hair back. Hey, now that we're on Elkhart Lake, I'm going to bring up a bit of a sadness, but it has to do with just life and life passing. Is that it was at Elkhart Lake that I not first started noticing John Paul, but I watch everybody. So I was out on the track. So Rob and or somebody, be it James Weaver, someone was in the Porsche at the moment. I was standing down on turn five, trying to figure out how to get through that turn better and up the hill. And John Paul Jr. comes through, and I noticed that if someone had been in his way or something had happened, he rarely made mistakes at this time in his life. Spectacular driver. And I would notice that he would clutch the car, meaning he had his foot to the floor on the gas pedal, but he would depress the clutch to free the engine up for a second to pass more exhaust gas through the turbo to bring it online quicker. And I thought, hey, I need to talk to him about that. So the point of that is that, you know, clearly John Paul, through all of our lives, taught us all a lot. In my experience with JP on the racetrack, extremely, first of all, he's faster than all of us. The next thing is that he never put me at risk ever when he was passing me. So he was very comfortable, clean racer, and mind bending when he passed you. So that's one of the sad moments. The next one too is that one year Rob brought in Johnny Dumfries, who has also since passed. And Rob, I'll never forget when you took me aside, could you clearly tell that I was upset? It was, you know, my feeble ego was really worried about not being fast enough and not upholding the Dyson honor. And you took me aside and you said, look, I don't care how fast he is. At the end of the day, if you, that'd be me, Price, win the championship, they won't remember Johnny Dumfries. And I thought about that at length. Now, the good news is in the dry, we were relatively equal. In the wet, he was otherworldly. And
that was such a spectacular run that he had. But you know something? He was an accident waiting to happen. And this was the saddest thing. We were leading the championship. And this was the IMSA championship in the GTP cars in the 80s. I mean, we were running against the top factory teams everywhere, including Holbert. And we won that race, and we went down to San Antonio. And I was out of the car. I wasn't in the car, but and Dumfries came down with Price because I tried to get somebody else. I tried to get Klaus Ludwig because I knew that Klaus could do the job and not be so kind of strange. Dumfries was a strange kind of a guy and a cocky. He felt he should be in Formula One. So he was a cocky guy. And, you know, here he was, you know, racing an IMSA car. But when we went down to San Antonio, and Dumfries screwed up and put the car in a wall, and that ended our chance of winning the championship. And the only thing I can tell you, that was the saddest time in my life, was that fact that I couldn't get somebody to back up Price. And in point of fact, it turned out that my instinct was maybe I should be driving with him in the last couple races. Turns out that maybe he'd have won the championship if I was driving in the final couple races. Because I know one thing, I wouldn't have put anything in a wall, and I wouldn't have had any problems at Columbus, because that's where Dumfries had problems. He wasn't fast at Columbus. He couldn't get the street race. He couldn't figure it out.
Well,
but, you know, that also, we came close, boy.
We did, but also, too, would have been
it would have been fantastic to have you in the car. And I want to remind everybody that, and Rob, I know I've said it to your face, but you were as fast as anybody I'd ever met. I was just grateful that you had other interests which kept you from being that unbelievable person every moment you sat in the car. Now let's reflect back to Sears Point one year where you held, and I'm pretty sure, again, we won that race, but you held the best of the best at bay. It didn't matter who was behind you, ex-Formula One guys, the best of the best, the Ludwigs, the John Watsons, the BMW, mighty BMW cars, and March whatevers. You held them all at bay, and that says it all. So it was great for me to be there with you at Dyson Racing.
Well, that was a great, that was, you know, we had some great runs. You know, you talked about Riverside, Trish. Riverside was a very interesting experience for both Price and I. I don't know, Price, if you had ever run it before, but I'd never seen the place before we got down there with the Porsche. I'd never even been there. I knew it. You know it from car magazines, and in those days, nothing was televised. So when we got there, you know, it was a track that we just absolutely, you know, I mean, I'd seen it on television, and they used it in a lot of Hollywood movies about racing and stuff. But we had the Porsche. It was actually a brand new Porsche. It was chassis number 120, which was probably the best chassis we had, because when I finally realized that it wasn't going to work out with Drake's, and I knew that that was not going to happen anymore. So we got a car. He had destroyed a car, and we had to get it. We were repairing one and got another one. And in those days, the cars weren't that expensive. I mean, it's all relative, of course. And we went out to Riverside, and every practice session we were improving the car as we were fact building it, finishing off the paint, because we didn't do any paint on the car. We had to paint it up, get it cleaned up, but on the outside. But we kept on adjusting it. And Price, this is where Price had this remarkable sense, and he, working with Smitty, they worked very quickly on gears in the gearbox, working the gears, trying to understand ride height and getting the shock set up, because the car was just literally out of the box. So it was a car that had to be completely adjusted, stringing the suspension, making sure that the wheel alignment, everything had to be done. And by golly, what happened was, when Price went out to qualify, I think we qualified third or fourth, but we could run that speed all day long. So the car was solid. Well, fortunately, Price went out and started running really great and put the car in a position. I think we were running either first or second when Price turned the car over to me. And when I went out, I knew I had a fast car, and we were able to win that race. And that one race was called the LA Times Grand Prix, one of the classic, great, important road major races in the sports car history in this country. And we ran the long course at Riverside too, which meant that we had the longest configuration that they had. And that was the second to last time that the IMSA cars ran, because we went back there the year later and we ran a shorter course, and I don't think we did as well, but that was really a thrill. And it was only because Price could figure out the gearing in a session. And Smitty could make sure that we got it in the car for the next session. So it was Price working with the guys that enabled us to get the car ready to get it going. So, you know, it was really that union and kind of a good communication that I tried to encourage it. This isn't rocket science. And I think Price is absolutely right when he says it's just a car. Now, granted, it's more sophisticated. It's got more parts to break. It's got more parts to adjust. It's got more bits and pieces. But the fundamentals have to be covered. And if anybody knew the fundamentals of making a car work, it was Pat Smith. From his line mechanic, you know, he was a flat rate mechanic at a car dealer. I mean, these guys, he knows what makes a car work. And then Price, who had the race sense from all of his Formula Atlantic and his road racing, because those guys changed their gears from one session to another to make the car go a half of a tenth faster. And so it was those two guys working that enabled us to win a lot of races, Riverside and Sears being two of my major wins, but us being competitive in dozens of other races.
Rob, well, as you recall, there was an oddity. So the car was new, and in the race, there was something that became apparent with the wastegates. And don't forget, new wastegates, what do we know, right? So in talking to Pat while we were running, we figured out that if you got the power to come on full bore in, let me back up. So the wastegates would either give you normal boost or under boost. But if you timed for, and don't ask me why, we never figured this out, but if you timed the rise of the turbocharger to full boost to be in sync with the whimsical, am I going to give you full boost or not, of the wastegate, it would run full power. But if you mistimed it, it was down about 50 or 60 horsepower guesstimate. So we talked about it over the radio, and eventually, Rob, you may not remember that, but it made a big difference. We could have run faster yet, but that was as fast as we got to go. We still won the race.
Yeah, the funny deal was in those days, and it's far more sophisticated now, the wastegates were just literally a pressure spring. Now they're, and you remember the days when we always were upgrading. That was one of the big things that they were doing, was constantly upgrading the wastegates and the intercoolers, and putting the intercoolers on top of the engine and changing all rear of the bodywork and all that stuff. But you're right, that was the thing that was very interesting to kind of figure out how you could trick the car, the engine, to keep the boost at a certain level that you didn't take it one little bit. You kind of rode the curve up, but you didn't, you stopped there, because if you went over and triggered the wastegates, you're right, the blowback, that thing would go blow it out, and boy, it just, you could feel the whole car just kind of shudder a little as it was slowing down. You're right.
Hey, do you recall the year we were at Daytona, and this goes to the robustness of Porsche, although my first words may make you wince, but in the night, Drake was driving the car, and something happened to the wastegate, and it overboosted, and it ultimately broke a piston. And you guys, between you and Pat Smith, discussed it, and even the Porsche guys were, of course, this would never be permitted today, but they allowed you, and Porsche suggested that you pull a fuel injector line, in other words, the electrical connector, pull it off, and continue to run the car. Of course, it was pumping oil like crazy, running on five cylinders, but that it continued on, and I don't know how much longer it was, maybe 2 hours, you know, but Dyson Racing was still able to finish the race with five cylinders. One, you could actually see the piston through the broken cylinder.
I remember, and the funny thing the whole deal was is that it was, because that was when we were, you know, trying to run for a championship. So you got to run and get as many points as you can.
Right.
And the 24 hours awarded, I don't know whether they did plus points. They might have done plus points then. But you're right, and we had to keep it running. Mm-hmm. So you're right. They never allow you to do what we did. And nowadays.
Think of all the oil we put out on the track, and we get to keep
doing it. How to get rid of the competition.
But you and Elliot you and Elliot could do a real job on those, coasting the car and all the thing. I didn't quite get it. I could not go as fast as you guys were going. You guys were only about, we were only about maybe 6 seconds slower on five cylinders. It was remarkable how once you get the technique down, these guys, you know, Price and Elliot, they figured it out. I could not quite do it. I just couldn't quite get the knack of it. So I never I took myself out of the car because I said we're losing time over and above what we're already losing, you know.
Oh, on that happy story, we're going to have to wrap it up. I know you've got a lot more to tell us. How would you feel about coming back and doing this again sometime?
I'll tell you, being with Price, absolutely no problem, not any problem at all.
Well, each one of you have a lot of stories to tell about your own careers, but the time
Price,
that y'all get together seems to be the most interesting, I'm sure.
Price can tell you about all three times he ran Le Mans.
I know it. He won a few times too, didn't he?
Only won once. It was good. Wait till we tell you the story about the first time Rob and I went over there, though. That's a wonderful story.
Okay. Well, we got to come back.
All right.
Just give us some time to crank it up, and you'll be the next time we'll hear it.
Well, thank you. Bryce, I'll give you. Rob, it's my pleasure. Go ahead.
Hey, buddy, I'll give you a holler in the next couple of days.
Okay, I look forward to it.
Don't hang up.
Okay. All right, we're staying on. Okay.
And thanks for listening for everybody. We're going to wind it up here with a promise to do this again. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on racinghistoryproject.com. Also on the new Internet Archive, archive.org. Coming up on July 28th at our regular time of 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, we'll have Carrie Earwood and Janet Upchurch. I'm sorry, Janet. I know she's listening to me and her name just fell out of my head. Does that ever happen to anybody else? Does anybody have any questions out there? Anybody want to chime in real quick? Hello?
You talking to us, Trish, or?
I was talking to the audience. If there was anybody in the audience that wanted to chime in for a moment.